Jed Pearl, the notoriously opinionated art critic for The New Republic, has just completed an ambitious 557-page book on New York's art scene from the 1940s to the 1970s, and he's here now to discuss that exciting time and to explain how New York came to be one of the world's most important art centers after World War II. The book is called New Art City, published by Knopf. I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today.
Delighted to be here.
Did you feel you needed to adapt your writing style in order to write this book? Is there a big difference between writing for a magazine like The New Republic or The New Criterion and writing 557-page tome?
Well, writing a long book is a different kind of rhythm. You have this wonderful luxury of writing chapters and putting them away in a drawer for months and then looking at them again. So it's a slower process. It's a process that evolves. And you put things down and you look at them and change them and you move things around a lot. A book like this is built on an enormous, complicated foundation. So that was fun as a contrast to the close deadlines of The New Republic.
But writing art history is different than writing another kind of a history. Opinions are part of the process, aren't they? Objectivity isn't always something to be striven for.
Well, the thing that brought me to writing this book, New Art City, was my own desire to look back at the period that's really the prologue to the period we're living in now. I wanted to write a history of the mid-century years in New York that reflected this heterogeneity, the marvelous melting pot complexity, the tapestry richness that I feel there is in the New York art world. So I was, in a way, backing up from this attention to the present to try to get a deeper perspective on how we got where we are today.
And it all pretty much happened after World War II. Now, New York was an exciting place before World War II, wasn't it?
New York was an extraordinary place in the arts from the very beginning of the 20th century. And there are places in this book where I dip back into the 1930s. There were a lot of things happening, you might say, under the surface, at the edges in New York in the 20s and 30s, extraordinary galleries beginning to develop. A lot of artists who were excited by Cubism, by new European ideas, working quietly, working downtown, not getting a huge amount of attention. And there's all this stuff happening, you might say, under the radar before the war. And then what happens during and then after the war, and this is this thrilling thing that happens in New York, is this an almost a kind of catalytic reaction when there's a younger generation of artists and poets, painters like Joan Mitchell, poets like John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara, people who kind of come out of college situations, out of a rather prosperous middle-class world, and they're arriving in New York, and they're having these incredible encounters with these kind of hard-bitten, hard-scrabble old-timers, people like de Kooning, who weren't even that old themselves at that time, but who'd really struggled through a life during the Depression in New York. And these two groups kind of confront each other, places like the Cedar Tavern and the Artist Club, and they energize one another. The young people who have this wild post-war optimism, they're given a kind of gravitas, in a way, by the older guys. And the older guys, and Hans Hoffmann, the great teacher who'd come here from Europe in the 30s, he talked about this, how these young people gave you this kind of injection of freshness. So there was this amazing thing of groups kind of bouncing off of one another after the war.
Well, in other books, much has been made of the fact that all these European emigres came to New York and had an impact. But I'm not talking about Hoffman,
right,
who had played a different role in the New York art scene, but people like Masson and Pete Mondrian. Do you think that that was very important, or was there something already bubbling up here with the WPA and the artists like de Kooning
these cultural Arshil moments
Gorky,
when a city finds itself, and it the visual arts tend to happen in certain places, certain times, whether it's Florence or Bruges or Paris or New York. It's a confluence of so many different forces, and it's of course, the arrival of surrealists like Masson, of Mondrian, who spent his last years in New York and was happier here, he said, than he'd been anywhere else in the world. That is an element, too.
Because the street grid, I suspect.
Well, he also found here young artists who were up for anything, who were responsive to the wildness of this pure abstraction in a way that he hadn't found many people who were in Europe.
This is a time when abstraction becomes the dominant style, and representational painters from the older generation and younger ones complain that they kind of cut out.
Well, abstraction was certainly the and a kind of expressionist abstraction specifically was certainly the dominant style. But one of the things I really wanted to do in New Art City was recomplicate this story and show how many different kinds of art, including all kinds of representational painting, were happening at the same time. And one of the fascinating things is that artists who were doing very, very different kinds of things were responding to one another. I tell a story of a painter of still lifes and figures named Earl Kirkham, who's not that well known today. I tell about the enormous importance that his opinion had for Jackson Pollock. We forget that Fairfield Porter, an artist who many people are interested in admire today, marvelous painter of landscapes, cityscapes, figures. Fairfield Porter was a very close friend of Bill de Kooning's. And it's, in fact, Bill de Kooning who got Fairfield Porter his gallery break, who introduced Porter to his first gallery.
Well, you get the sense that there was a lot more of a dialogue going on at that time. There were two or three places that artists hung out at. And they all, as you say, knew each other. There was even a club that right. included a bunch of artists. And that doesn't happen anymore. Now it's all broken up into little cliques.
I don't think this is only true in the visual arts. I think it's also true among writers. When you talk to people who came of age back then, they tell about running into friends on street corners, and somebody says, "Oh, did you see the new Balanchine ballet?" So we get people stand on the street corner for 2 hours talking about that or de Kooning's new show. Partly it was. There was a very special scale to the scene at that point. It was a scene that was expanding, that was getting bigger, but it was still, as you say, a scene in which people could know everybody else and everything else was happening. There was a kind of, to the world of downtown art on 10th Street and 8th Street, there was a sort of sense of a village within the metropolis, a city within the city, and it's harder for artists to have that today.
You give a lot of time and attention to Hans Hofmann in this book. Do you think he deserves more recognition than he's received? And is it as a painter or is it as a teacher who had such an impact on his students?
I think Hans Hofmann deserves a lot more attention in all ways. And I think one of the things about Hofmann that I think has been hard for people is that he is a very complicated figure. Part of the reason someone like Jackson Pollock has gotten to be kind of the guy at the head of the class, it's not just the quality of his work. It's also that you can kind of summarize, or people feel they can summarize what he did in a word or two. He's the guy who tore the door off the bathroom at the Cedar Tavern. He was the drunk. The thing about Hofmann was he did many different kinds of paintings. There are these exuberant, crazy, painterly things he did. He also experimented with all kinds of geometries. He had an impact on all different kinds of painters. He was somebody who was marvelously, you might say, almost promiscuous in what he was interested in. He wanted people to paint landscapes and still lifes and pure abstractions. And at the very end of his life, he himself was talking about painting landscape again.
It's interesting also that although he's an emigre, his work becomes so American in a way that few other emigre artists do. It's easier to spot Arshil Gorky as a European, or even de Kooning for much of his early career. Hans Hofmann looks from the start like somebody who just came here and became an American painter.
And he did it when he was in his 50s, which is astonishing.
My guest is Jed Pearl. His new book, New Art City, Manhattan at Mid-Century, is published by Knopf. Anyone listening will get the feeling that you don't have as positive a take on Jackson Pollock as most others do. I can't think of an artist who came along after Pollock who didn't consider him one of the greats of the 20th century. Are they all wrong? Are they missing something? Are they overrating him?
One of the things I've tried to do in New Art City is bring us back to a sense of being on the ground as it's happening, rather than standing back from the art of the mid-century years. I think Pollock did some extraordinary paintings. I also think Nell Blaine, wonderful painter of still lifes and landscapes, did. Burgoyne Diller, an extraordinary abstract painter, much admired by many of his abstract expressionist buddies. The important thing, I believe, is to see the life of art as more open, more porous, more variable, more nuanced than we sometimes have a tendency to do today. And part of the way I tell the story of Pollock in this book is through the way that people were responding to him, how they were understanding him. And you know, sometimes what happens, especially in the history books, the ones that people read in Art 101, is that everything gets simplified to a few greatest hits.
But I think that most of those artists will tell you that the reason they love Jackson Pollock, or Barnett Newman for that matter, is that they gave them the sense that anything was possible, that they gave them that they broke with European art in a way of how to compose a painting, and they said to them, you can do whatever you wish. Ellsworth Kelly later says that he made a promise to himself that he would never question any idea that he had, and that just liberated him.
Well, most of the past 30 years I've spent among artists and writers, and one of the things I find about artists and writers is that they have all kinds of surprising, loopy turns and twists in their taste and in their attention. And in many respects, New Art City is a testament, a salute to the taste of all different kinds of artists, including many very well-known artists. And the byways, not only the highways, but also the byways of their taste. There's a marvelous show up now at the Alan Stone Gallery of John Graham, an amazing eccentric painter of the 1930s and 40s, who had a great influence on many figures, on de Kooning and David Smith and so on. And you'd be amazed. You ask all kinds of very well-known painters, who do they love? John Graham will be a name that they mention. And part of what I've tried to do is not knock the usual suspects, but bring a lot of other people back into the story. And this really, for me, is a reflection of my love of this city, which is a city where you walk down the street and you see so many different things happening at the same time.
And New York is a character in this book.
Totally.
Now, up until this time, Paris, earlier Berlin, had been major centers of abstraction before Stalin came to power, Moscow. Why New York at that moment, do you think? And why did Paris suddenly lose it totally?
Well, Paris didn't completely lose it. There's been amazing art going on in Paris, especially in the second half of the 20th century, people like Jacques Cometti and Balthus.
Yeah, but they were older generation. The next guys that come along, Soulages and the like, they're painting their French versions of American paintings.
Again, I think it's a confluence of a lot of different things. Economics certainly plays into it. Art centers, visual art centers, do also tend to be centers of all kinds of economic activity and excitement, because art is, for better and for worse, something that's bought and sold. So again, it's a... you might say that the history of art is a kind of moving feast, and it stops in different places at different times.
You've been fairly critical of the Museum of Modern Art recently. How important was it to the art scene in the mid-century?
The Museum of Modern Art was founded in 1929, and it really grew up along with the artists. One of the interesting things about the mid-century relationship between the Museum of Modern Art and the artists was the artists were often extremely pissed off at the Museum of Modern Art. There were endless complaints from abstract expressionists and from critics who supported them, like the great Thomas Hess, that the Museum of Modern Art was not quick enough to respond to their work. And there was a very rich, complicated back and forth. On the other hand, the artists invited Alfred Barr, the great founder of the Museum downtown, to preside at some of their discussions. I think what's happened to the Museum of Modern Art increasingly, and certainly in the last year since its reopening, is it's become less our hometown Museum of Modern Art than it's become part of a kind of international consortium of museums. People say to me today, I go into the Museum of Modern Art, I could be in Tate Modern, I could be in the Guggenheim and Bilbao, I could be in the Pompidou. And that is a loss for us.
Another loss is cheap a studio space, isn't it? It's people are now moving into Greenpoint, and they're going to have problems there as well.
Oh, the economics, it's not just for the visual arts, as you know. It's for dancers. It's for writers. The economics of the city has become increasingly difficult for artists. I have to say, though, at the same time, that exciting things continue to happen. I mean, there's a wonderful new video artist, Jeremy Blake, who I'm very excited about.
But I get the sense that artists are now more willing to live outside of New York City than they were in the past.
Well, they have no choice, really. And one of the problems is that this cuts into a sense of community, which when you look at those mid-century years, the sense of downtown as being this kind of marvelous bohemian neighborhood is something we've lost.
Jed Pearl will be giving a reading, a talk, and signing books this Thursday at the Barnes & Noble store on Broadway and 82nd Street. That's at 7 o'clock. And then there's another on the 6th. You can find out details on our show page at WNYC.org. The book is New Art City, Manhattan at Mid-Century. It is published by Knopf. And I want to thank you very much for being with us. By the way, just one more thing. No relation to the people who own the Pearls Gallery.
No, really.
Because they represented everything in opposition to what you're talking about here.
They showed Calder. I love Calder.
Well, they showed, but mostly they showed great European artists like Miro. Anyway, thank you again so much for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thanks a lot.